So I think a couple of months ago, I think Piero asked me to give that talk. Then afterwards, he had the brilliant idea that we need a bit more discussion. So that talk will actually not happen, and instead we'll have a panel discussion on what more can we learn from closed option systems. He also asked me to give a bit of an introduction to the discussion, probably to sweeten the pill a bit that I'm not giving that talk and have to organize a discussion. When he asked me that, my first idea was that I should say no, but then I remembered that I had asked him something similar some time ago and had asked him at the Cambridge meeting to change his topic as well because it fitted better into the program. And he probably remembered that as well and thought I couldn't say no. And he was quite right, and in that sense, I think I deserve what I got, and you will have to live with that discussion session. So there will be a... down, let's pull out. So we will in a few minutes have the discussion with these six people, most of whom will know these reasonably well, and I have to give a bit of an introduction as well, what will be a bit of a conference summary in the middle of the conference. That's new to me as well, but I think Piero in its infinite wisdom thought that we should have that. So what more can we learn from QSO absorption systems? I think we can learn a lot, but certainly much more than we can discuss here, so we have to be a bit selective. And the way we will run that later is that we have picked six topics that, as I'm not very different from Piero, I just asked the six other people to basically share one topic so that I don't have to do that on my own. So what we have seen, absorption lines, the main reason that they have been studied for so long, and nevertheless many issues are very controversial, is that in the individual spectra there's a lot of information, but it's basically all stapled on top of each other, and it's very difficult to actually disentangle what is absorbed by what and to get actually a physical picture out what is responsible for the whole thing. I think the field has really made a lot of progress now that you can actually make the combined study of looking and things in emission and have a look what you're actually looking at, and then do the more physical quantities and look at them in absorption. And that was, I think, became most clear in Jacques' talk, and I think we will see much more of that, and that will actually help a lot to entangle the enormous amount of information that's in principle in these spectra. I think there are now more than 100 high resolution spectra. Each of these spectra has about 20,000 pixels, and typically you have a signal to noise of 30 to 50 in each pixel. So in principle there's much more in these spectra, I think, than we have got out, and it's to a large extent, I think, manpower limited. I think there's much less models than you actually could get out of the spectra, and I'm quite confident that we will see more of that. So first on Lyman limit and damped Lyman alpha systems, I think what we have seen there is that the sample size has increased dramatically. I think we have seen that in Jason's talk. But nevertheless, I think there we suffer probably most strongly that we have no idea what these systems actually, or no firm idea what these systems are. We don't know for sure what kind of part or what kind of part of the galaxies is, what kind of galaxies is. They trace very nice the warm, cold gas, but we don't know quite where that gas sits. And they trace a metal evolution, but we don't know the metal evolution of which gas and how that fits in. And particularly, we don't know why the metallicity is so low. Sorry for not turning that off, I think. Then in the associated metal systems, you can probe the spectral shape of the UV background, you can probe the metal enrichment by QSO galactic winds, and maybe the fossil record of the first light in the universe. I think here we haven't got out what we can out, in my opinion, mainly because these things play together. I think you need to know the shape of the spectral UV background to actually infer the other things more properly. And I'm pretty sure we will see more of that as well. Then coming to the Lyman forest as such, this probe of quite a number of things, first of reionization, and we have discussed that with this very nice spectra of Xiao, where he showed that if you go to higher redshift that you actually see this absorption trough. And I think there, these spectra are more of a serious stream because they are basically so bad quality that you fit your models much better. And that's the reason we are struggling so far and can't even tell if the gas is neutral or not. But I think the main reason is that there's not that much information in these spectra. I think there's a hope that if you get more of these and better spectra, that we still figure out that figure a bit more out of what's going on at that redshift, and particularly there's a hope to go to even higher redshift and maybe find a gamma ray burst at redshift 8 that's really very, very bright and learn something at even higher redshift and get a really good quality spectrum at higher redshift. I think then that field would probably make enormous progress as well. Then the thermal history of the IGM, I think somehow that seems to have fallen asleep. There wasn't any discussion of that at that meeting, and probably there isn't much apart from the talk from Zoltan Heimann. I think there's this Oder plot from Zoltan where you have a strong rise of the temperature at the redshift around 3, and that's one of the indications that there might be helium reionization occurring late. But I would still question if we actually believe that. If you remember the plot that Zoltan showed, he puts the temperature at redshift 4 above here, and I think that hasn't been confirmed independently. And I would claim the temperature here at these redshifts could be either lie here or it could be lying down here as well. So I think I think more could be done, and I don't think the spectra have been fully explored on that question. On the amplitude of the UV background, we had the talk by the very nice talk by Scott, and there's a number of methods with which you can actually measure that. There's the proximity effect, the Lyme alpha 4 is opacity, and the integrated emissivity. Unfortunately, each of these have error bars of a factor 2 or 3. And I think it would be very nice to actually make progress here and nail them down and get a consistent value for all three of them. And I think that should be possible in the next couple of years as well. I think what's new in that field is two things that I would just like to mention briefly. The one thing is that there's people started to look more carefully and what the predictions would be for an inhomogeneous UV background. So if you have individual sources with different lifetime, and a nice paper Rupert Croft actually worked out what the intensity fluctuations would be. So that's a box 500 megaparsec on the side. That's a UV background that's dominated by quasars of a certain lifetime, 10^7 and 10^8 years. And then you see these light cone effects that you actually see shells of photons rather than spheres that wander through the intergalactic medium. And the main contrast here is about a factor 2 in both directions in the UV background. It would be very nice to actually observe that by looking at the transverse proximity effect and learn something about that. And it will be a nuisance for other things as well. Another thing what people are trying currently, and that's something where I'm involved in, is actually trying to see the UV background in re-emission. So the Lyman limit systems are optically sick to UV photons. They should reflect the UV photons in a sense, and that should give a very faint extended signal, and that can actually in principle be seen with long exposures of a 10-meter telescope, and that's something what we're trying to do at the moment. Galactic winds, I think that's one of the things we will discuss later. There, Chuck showed this nice new update. So the old plot was that as you went closer to the Lyme break galaxies, there was some matter leading to a decreased mean flux level, but very close, there was this very puzzling result that there seemed to be some sort of a hole of 0.5 megaparsec where there was hardly any absorption. And there was a number of groups who tried to model that and basically all failed. And the main problem was to get that point up here so high and get that very rapid decrease as you go to larger distances. That's one attempt where we tried to do that, a student of Adi Nasser, Vincent Dejac. So what we did here is we just put down bubble sizes, spherical bubbles, into the simulations artificially and varied the bubble size. And you can see that then you get these curves here and you can bring them up, but it's very hard. You need very large bubbles of 1.5 h to the minus 1 megaparsec moving, but you get never such a rapid rise. So even for the largest bubble size, so if you increase it further, you get it further up, but then you're going here and you will never get that rapid fall. So we basically concluded that these must be a statistical fluke, that there were only a few galaxies up there that had a hole. And I think quite nicely we saw yesterday that that's actually the case. So in this updated sample from Steidel that he showed yesterday, showed that there's actually a distribution of flux decrements within 1 megaparsec. A wide range, it seems to be maybe even a bimodal distribution. That's a plot that we published at the time, where we basically the same plot, is just the other way around. So here's a flux decrement, here's the mean flux, and it's a logarithmic plot. So for convenience, I've asked Vincent just yesterday to redo that plot in the same way as here, and you see that you get a very broad distribution. You might not get that bimodal distribution. That might tell us something what Chuck has said yesterday, that these winds might actually be multiphase, and that there are dense clumps in the wind, and occasionally in these bubbles you will have very, very large absorption. And that's something what we might discuss later a little bit. What the nice thing is, now you can do it with moderate size bubbles, so maybe smaller than a megaparsec co-moving, what would mean that the volume filling factor that's affected is less than 1% of the total. And I would actually make a somewhat provocative statement that nowhere we have actually compelling evidence that more than 1% of the volume is affected by galactic winds, neither in this measurement nor in the metals. Then large-scale structure distribution of matter and cosmology, that would have been my talk, but as I said, we skip that. I just say briefly what the idea is. With the Lyme alpha forest, you measure the fluctuation amplitude on very small scales, compare that to what you get on large scales, and this way you can actually constrain the primordial power spectrum of density fluctuation. That's of quite some interest to people who are doing inflationary physics, but I just skip these slides. And we're now going over to a panel discussion. I would ask the panelists to come forwards and lead one by one of these questions. So we have decided on 6, and that's the first one that Chuck had agreed to lead the discussion on. And the way we wanted to run that was that we didn't find it reasonable just to have a discussion amongst the 6 of us, but that we have a bit more discussions involving the audience as well. You have changed the question. He wants to use his laptop.
I just wanted to, because I wanted, if I have a few minutes, I want to talk sure. about the next generation.
Fine.
Mention the next generation telescope, because I think it'd be interesting.
As you see, that format hasn't been probed before, and I think the format was designed by Piero, so I don't want to take the blame for that.
Oh, never mind. You know what?
We were not supposed to show slide. We were not supposed to show slide.
What?
We were not supposed to show anything.
I told you could show one slide, but if you really... could you come forward?
I thought it was interesting, and it's unfortunate. I think the next talk is going to be really relevant to this question. But, I mean, assuming you believe that you even have to worry about feedback from either star formation or... Is this on? Can anyone hear this?
Not on.
Green LED?
No.
On. It's on, but not loud. All right. Whoa. I'm assuming you think this is relevant to anything. I'm curious to know, you know, what do people think about AGN versus star formation, and you know, when you talk about feedback, you talk about needing to get metals out into the intergalactic medium. That's one issue, and then there are issues of needing to inject energy, and that might be related or not directly related. And I was wondering, maybe we'll find out in the next talk, you know, how how these two different how you would discriminate between feedback dominated by AGN and feedback dominated by supernova and star formation. And also I was wondering in the same context when people think AGN happen relative to when the star formation happens presumably in the same galaxies, that most the galaxies that are producing most of the metals are the same ones that produce most of the AGN activity at the relevant redshifts. And so how do things happen in what order? And how would you actually get an observational handle on how to tell the difference? So with that short introduction, I would like to open it up for discussion.
Well, let me just reverse the question. Suppose that you're observing one of your galaxies. How could you tell that there is no varied AGN or active galactic nuclei there? Observationally.
Yeah, okay. Well,
tell if there's an AGN there or not? Well, it's usually pretty obvious if there is, actually. At these kinds of redshifts, if you can identify it at all, they tend to actually have AGN signatures, either in the ultraviolet spectrum or the near-infrared rest frame optical spectrum. And you can test this against things that are in the X-ray samples, and you find a very small fraction of things at these redshifts that look like normal star-forming galaxies that have some indication of being an AGN. So it's usually obvious observationally.
I'm not sure.
To give him the mic.
There's a very large number of objects at Z equals 1 or 1.5 where you could never tell there was an AGN in it based on the optical spectrum, either in the near IR or on the optical. Yeah, I mean, and I know of a few objects at Z equals 2 that are known X-ray emitters inside the Chandra samples that basically don't look any different from a standard sort of LBG type spectrum. So I think I know of examples at Z equals 2. I think there's some discrimination there in the sense that there's a lot of Z equals 2 X-ray sources that we can't directly identify, but that based on photometric redshift estimators are in the 1.5 to 2 range. And I think that's just a selection effect. I suspect those things would in fact be the X-bongs, if you like to call them that, or whatever, right? The bright optical normal galaxies, right, in those samples. And they're just prejudiced against.
I agree, but I guess the question was, how would I know if in things that I'm looking at there's an AGN there? And I think it's relatively rare to find something that has external evidence for AGN hood but doesn't have a signature in the spectrum at redshifts greater than 2. And that's true in the X-ray sample too. They're in the minority.
I'd like to respond to that directly. I mean, from comparisons of optically selected deep AGN samples with COMBO 17 and the corresponding X-ray identification in the Chandra DP itself, we find that what you said is valid for low luminosity AGN in large numbers, that's true, but above a certain luminosity threshold, every single X-ray selected AGN is also optically selected. That corresponds to something like an MB minus 21, minus 22, roughly. That's about the transition border. So all the more luminous AGN have these optical UV signatures. Yes, yeah, that's true. Indeed. Yeah. Yeah, but in terms of total UV output, if we integrate the luminosity function, then these lower luminosity AGN below that limit roughly, they correspond very little to the overall UV photon budget. So, except maybe locally, but... Yes. I'd like to make another comment on the other question that you raised about which comes first, or in what order does star formation and AGN happen. We've conducted extensive studies, color-based and spectroscopic, on AGN samples of different redshifts, and we find always signatures of the AGN host galaxies to be blue in terms of showing significant star formation, but none of them are really very blue, so none of them are really starbursts apparently. They're typically mildly blue, indicative of star formation a few hundred mega years ago. So that really points to a kind of a characteristic timescale between the starburst, if there was one, and the ongoing AGN activity.
But these are presumably all low redshift AGN?
No, this this in the moment is based on low redshift and redshift one-ish AGN, and we will see whether the same is true. We have indications for the same thing on based on HST data at redshift 2, and we'll get additional NICMOS data to corroborate that.
We'll be able to tell at redshift 2.
There really isn't actually very much difference in the characteristics of the field sample and the X-ray selected sample once you simply go on to the most luminous galaxies from which the X-ray sources are actually drawn. Right, they have the same distribution. So you can't actually tell, you can tell almost nothing, I think. Not a big difference between the X-ray selected sources and the field samples. Oh, but that's the AGN characteristic spectral signatures. If you
have a broad, if you look at the a stack of broad line objects that have typical luminosities the same as the galaxies in the UV, you don't see any sign of an interstellar medium still there, as you see in every single galaxy spectrum. That's the thing that makes me think that. If these objects are relatively gas poor by the time the AGN happens, that and other things suggest that this delay between the important phase when most of the stars are formed and when most of the most obvious AGN activity is happening. But I mean, it's all empirical and subject to all sorts of selection effects.
Just to comment a little bit about the metals, just from energetics, you can know that the AGN themselves can't be the source of most of the metals because the stuff is coming out so fast, if you look in broad absorption line winds and such, that, if you say all of that stuff, just say it was all metal, then in that case you would heat everything around it, you know, much, much higher than what you see in clusters and that sort of thing. So, I mean, AGN can maybe move some gas that's sort of further away and metal-enriched out into the intergalactic medium, but can't sort of be coming directly out just because of the what's coming out so fast. So that's all.
I think that's probably right if it's actually the quasar outflow that you're seeing. But another possibility that's been brought up recently is that you could drive winds by radiation pressure, and potentially it could be not just stellar radiation pressure, but quasar radiation pressure. So then you could drive a momentum-driven wind at lower velocities using the radiation of the quasar. And that might be an interesting thing to look into. Yeah, dust in the galaxy. Yeah, as gas in a galaxy is, dust-rich. Onto the dust. The dust couples the radiation pressure to the gas and imparts momentum on it. Yeah.
Quick question. Is there any evidence of you know, galactic winds from AGN that are optically selected? Can you look at quasar pairs, maybe, and see whether there are metals being ejected from radio quiet AGN?
When the same people look for the transverse proximity effect in the UV, they would basically see the effect of the winds as well, and these studies so far have been always disappointing so far. So even if you have an argument at pair, and then you always try to look what the one quasar does on the other side line, but you always struggle to see any effect. As soon as, so there are a few cases.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the problem with AGN winds is just that they're extremely unconstrained, both observationally and theoretically. With supernova-driven winds, we know how many ergs you get per gram of metal synthesized. And I mean, I don't know of a case where you can find an AGN-driven wind that's doing hydrodynamical damage on large scales. You see broad absorption line quasars, and there's clearly evidence for outflow of thermal material in a lot of AGN, but it's not, you know, you can't assign a mass flux or an energy flux to it for the most part, so it's...
Well, Gus Abrock was showing pictures that it was mechanical flows in very large distances.
You said something about this in the talk, which I
missed. I mean, whether things are important or not, of course, depends what issue you're interested in, but it seems to me both for AGN and for stellar winds, energetically, they could both be...
Feedback.
Am I getting feedback? That could both be strong. For example, the claim is with star formation winds that the mass loss rate is comparable to the star formation rate at velocities of several hundred kilometers a second in typical objects. So then that means since the intergalactic medium has roughly 10 times the baryons that there are in stars, has a temperature only 10,000 degrees, energetically the amount of energy coming out in the winds far greatly exceeds the total energy content of the medium. So there's an efficiency question, but in principle it could do damage. If it doesn't, that's presumably because a lot of the energy goes into radiation. Similarly for AGN, if you take all the radio galaxies over the history of the universe and integrate up the total energy density in relativistic plasma in the lobes, that again is comparable to the total energy density of the intergalactic medium. And in that case, the radiation processes are much less evident. So I think we shouldn't forget that it's possible that stuff is also being pushed around by essentially by dead radio lobes. And that would not be visible easily in any absorption indicator. So I think in both cases, there is plenty of energy available. And what actually happens depends on the loss mechanisms and also what we're interested in, I think. Clearly, radio lobes are not relevant for polluting the intergalactic medium with metals.
Right, yeah. That's why I discriminated between metals and moving energy.
Has anybody looked what the radio lobe actually looks like in absorption? I think in principle it can't be so difficult. They're quite big and there must be possible to have a background source. Does anybody know what they look like in absorption?
No, I know it was tried because I was on an HST tack that gave him time to do it. But that was 10 years ago, so obviously nothing. Yeah.
They probably failed to see anything.
Yeah, they didn't see anything, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe one should try that
again.
So
what's the picture then, that you have, Simon, of what do you think is more relevant?
I think it's the question you want to answer. I mean, say we were interested in how the heavy elements got into the intergalactic medium, they must have come from stars, and the only stars that we have direct evidence for are all in galaxies. So then we don't face the problem how they got there, even if it's only a small fraction.
Yeah, so what about making old galaxies look old at high redshift, suppressing star formation in the last bits of gas that...
Well, due to the great technology of the ITP, if you just log into your computer at the back, you can actually watch me giving my talk on the web since it's already been posted. But
I know what you said. I'm just asking you to recast it.
So I think there's no difficulty making big galaxies look old, provided that whatever it is that suppresses further star formation, whatever the feedback process is, first of all, it has to be a process which is most efficient in massive objects. And we're used to thinking about supernovae, and since Larson, everyone's argued that the supernova efficiency is most efficient in the small galaxies. What we need is something which is more efficient in the big galaxies. And secondly, whatever it is should not involve formation of large numbers of new stars, otherwise you would screw up the colors. So I don't know what the feedback process is, but that's what the properties it needs to have. So at AGN, it seems to me if you look up cooling flows, there's some evidence that the radio galaxies are doing the job there.
But this process could be really confined to galaxy groups and clusters, that you really need that setup of hot gas to feed the radio source, and then it only feeds back.
That's correct.
That potential valve. Exactly.
That was exactly the model that I implemented, and it can do the job.
I think it's less clear what happens in the high redshift galaxies at redshift 3 if you put an AGN in there. If they basically would have the same effect, or they could have none effect. But my suspicion would be the galaxies are more important.
that could well be. I mean, in the model that I showed, the AGN feedback at redshift 3 was insignificant. It wasn't doing anything.
And as we had seen as well, this mode of accretion really picks up in your model and in observations as well. That's the reason you picked it that way, at very late times when you have the cluster. So that's a very special configuration. A big black hole sitting in a hot gas tube.
That I think is right, but I think maybe one of the reasons we've seen so little evidence for any of these wind effects is that we're not looking for them in the correct way. And so I like to think of this as sort of the Sherlock Holmes effect, because you know there's one of the stories where the critical clue was the fact the dog didn't bark in the night. And you know, the if there really are large bubbles of hot gas in the interstellar medium, then the critical thing is there will not be any absorption in those particular regions. And so the information about those will actually be in the parts of the Lyman Alpha Forest where we don't see any lines. So if we continually just plot line statistics, it doesn't surprise me that we don't see very strong evidence for these things. What we should do is look at the statistics of the regions where there aren't any lines and see if somehow we can do that. And that might work better at high redshift just because there are more lines and so you're more sensitive.
It's a different accretion mode, so you have this very high hot gas sitting there that doesn't cool and feeds the black hole in that way. And that seems to make the radio jets, that makes the radio plasma that actually heats the cluster. So you might not have that configuration in a redshift 3 galaxy where all the gas might actually be coming in cool. But as you know as well, a cluster is very different from a galaxy, so that's not scale 3.
But again, I mean, I think the thought process should be, if you got it wrong there, but we may be getting it wrong in the other one as well, and these sort of types of energy feedback may be more effective than getting stuff out of the thought process. And I think if it were a kind of lesson to be true, that's probably there.
So who has the microphones? Did you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to say about Simon's point is that one of the most difficult things to reproduce about the Lyman Alpha 4 is, you know, we get a lot of statistics of lines right, but we don't get things like line separation statistics right, even when we should. I mean, you have volume effects and things like that. That's always been a strange thing that I've noticed. You even get correlations on small scales right, but these things where you see gaps in the Lyman Alpha 4, you can't reproduce them in simulations.
You have box size.
No, even looking in regions where, you know, you think that the box size would be large enough.
Yeah, you have to worry about
it. We should probably move on to the next question after Avishai's comment. Because we have four or five of these different questions. Yeah, go ahead.
We have 1.5 hours as well, so not yet.
On question two, with respect to not the matters, but rather the moving a lot of stuff out and stopping star formation. Energetically, we know that supernovae are going to be more important on small scales. It's hard to imagine on a Milky Way-sized galaxy how supernovae, unless the IMF is very top-heavy, will do big damage to a lot of the gas. The AGNs has the potential of doing it, but we don't really understand how exactly the energy goes into the medium. But I want to make the other point that it's also important not only the energy of the source, but also the victim. In other words, the gas that we are going to affect. And here, for example, it's important whether it's hot or cold. And we were talking about this cold versus hot medium. And they're going to respond differently to feedback. If you have a hot medium, which is more dilute, it will be easier for any energy or momentum, especially energy pushing wind, to remove the gas or heat it up or keep it hot, etc. if it's very cold, in clouds or in dense streams, it can be shielded against it, and it will, you know, you may keep on going, making stars and building disks, even though there's enormous energy in a wind throwing metals out and moving the hot gas out. So, just to conclude, the question that you raised, whether how do we shut off star formation to make big red objects at high redshift, I think it's a combination of the two. I mean, we can take one step backwards, and I mentioned this in my talk, before we even talk about feedback. The question is the gas flowing in cold and providing a lot of cold gas supply to the disk to make stars and so on, or are we shutting it by heating it up by shocks, by a very shock? And we've seen in simulation how this works. It works very nicely. So this by itself can stop star formation very effectively. If you want to maintain this hot gas hot for a while, then you need one of those feedbacks. And in a big object, I think supernovae are hopeless. You'll have to either top-heavy supernovae or AGNs in some magic way.
Of course, there's less gas to take care of once the object is big.
Less gas to take care of?
Once the stellar mass of an object is large, there's less residual gas to get rid of.
I'm talking about the gas that's in the halo that's coming in, it's preventing the supply.
I have a question.
I don't think there's no showstopper for supernovae doing it, but as Simon said, there's more than enough energy, it's just how you use it.
You should think of type 1A supernovae as well, there's all this iron that needs to get out.
I think we really move on to the next one, which is quite related, and that you basically agreed to share on the metal enrichment.
Is that the question?
That's the next question.
Yeah.
No, sorry. Oh,
yeah.
That's the right one.
Someone in the audience.
Well, I think next later I can talk about it.
You've got one. Oh,
yeah, you've got one with you.
No, no,
you have one.
Give it to people, you can do it yourself.
No, but then you can keep it till you decide who has it.
Well, we already had discussion about metal enrichment, so maybe we can keep this one a bit shorter than the others. I guess Martin asked me to talk about the filling factor, that's what he asked me to talk about, because he thought I would make some very controversial statement, which I'm usually not, I'm usually quite willing to do. But in terms of the filling factor of metal enrichment, actually I don't have a very strong statement to make at all.
Because I've changed the questions a bit, you might read them before you.
Well, he gave me another one, but yeah, the filling factor, that is the second one. I think we know very little about the filling factor of metals. It's also something that all the theorists want to know. What fraction of the volume is enriched is something very intuitive. Unfortunately, it's something extremely difficult to actually measure in practice. And there are several reasons why it's very difficult. One obvious one is that if you want to know what fraction of the volume is enriched with metals, you really have to know quite well what density you're looking at. Because almost all the volume is right at the mean density. And if you don't care, if you want to distinguish 70% enrichment from 20% enrichment, you have to know the density quite precisely. Factor of 2 in density difference is wrong. Unless you do everything in terms of spectral filling factor. If you do everything in spectral filling factor, you have a problem that redshift space is not the same as real space, which also gives you a big difference. However, if we are going to be controversial, maybe I can ask Martin a question. He said he was convinced that nothing had a filling factor greater than 1%, but as far as I know, you're the only one who's written a paper with a statement about a filling factor, and you came to 4%.
No, that's not what I said. I said we don't have conclusive evidence that it's larger than a percent. My best guess would be it's larger, but I don't think we have conclusive evidence for that. That it's not, we don't have conclusive evidence that it's larger than 1%. I think the two main arguments were from the kind of plots that Chuck has shown, and I think there you can come away with double sizes that are small enough that the volume factor is actually pretty small. And the other argument was the one that you introduced, that you see the metals in low density regions. But as you have pointed out, that's a statistical method, and what you actually see is some low optical depth H1 pixels to be associated with metal systems. But that doesn't mean, A, that all or that a large volume is actually affected. There's a lot of assumptions that go into that.
And that's
I
true.
I think probably the volume factor is larger than 1%, but I don't think we have actually conclusive evidence that it is. And that's a provocative statement that I just made at the beginning of this session, maybe to get the discussion a bit more lively, rather than that's something what I actually believe.
I do think it's quite, even if we don't know the volume filling factor, if we're not going to ever know whether it's you know, a few, or maybe ever, but not anytime soon, whether it's a few percent or a few tenths of a percent, I think I hope to show that we can already learn a lot from metal enrichment in terms of feedback prescriptions. I mean, the models just clearly don't work, and there's enough in a regime where we can safely measure things to show that things don't work. Let me actually read the questions then. Do we have a complete sense of metals, and how do we find out? Yeah, the last question, I think, is one of the things that is driving this field. And is it the Lyman Rake type galaxies, or is it something that happened at much higher redshift? I think the majority of people would probably think it's something at much higher redshift, but Chuck might disagree with that. The arguments for higher redshifts, I suppose, are that Tony Songela and others have shown that there might not be much evolution in the metallicity. Another argument is that if you're going to mess up the Lyman alpha force, the intergalactic medium, by winds, it's easier to do the high redshift far before the point where you have observations. Andrea and others have pointed out, and Piero, that issue. Another thing is what I showed, the simulations, that if they have to do it, they clearly currently don't predict the right distribution of metals. I don't know if anybody wants to comment on this.
So I think there's a simple argument that the answer to the first question is no. And that is, if you look, say, at redshift 2, for most people, star formation history is you've formed half of the present stars. And since most of the heavy elements come back quickly, you've already formed half of the heavy elements. We look in low redshift clusters, we see that most of the heavy elements are outside the galaxies. So the simple assumption would be they're outside the galaxies at redshift 2 as well. But if you take out, say, the damp Lyman alpha systems, so you look at things which you think are outside galaxies at redshift 2, and you add up the total amount of metals we've seen, it doesn't come to anywhere near the amount you would need to have half the total present metallicity of the universe.
I'm not sure that's completely clear, but Anthony may want to say something about it. But one thing I should say that I think is interesting is when people always talk about the cluster, intercluster medium, and they talk about the IGM that's observed at high redshift as being something different. If you take a cluster redshift 0, you go to redshift 3, it's actually quite low overdensity locally. It's still a high overdensity if you smooth it on a large scale. But locally, you should see that in the absorption. So those metals should also be seen, unless they're already much higher than 5K. Well, I think I showed during my talk that you have some constraints on that using element ratios. And the interesting thing is that it works if you have the right amount of metals at 10 to 4K, or if you put them at 10 to 6K, you can't see them. But if you better not have a lot of stuff at 10 to 5K. That's going to mess up.
So if we have
actually, those are the temperatures that you get from winds. You get the velocities that you take further than the temperature, normal shocks.
So if
then you get metals at the temperature regime, but you actually don't want them.
if we haven't seen most of the metals at redshift 3 and they're outside of galaxies, so what do we do to see them?
No, not that high redshift.
So you should like that. So you should pay time on something.
Some of it's just cool, right? Especially at high redshift.
I have a comment on that. If you look at redshift 3, we do see most of the baryons. When you do the detailed matching, the amount of absorption in the forest and consensus models and so on, we can account for all of the baryons in standard sort of simulations with no feedback and so on. I didn't even hear that. Sorry.
You see most of the mass, but not most of the volume.
That's not what the simulators find. They have a real problem to get a volume filling factor of 1. And most people say the more microphysics you put in, the harder it gets. Now maybe he should say something, because can you give him the mic?
Well, I think that the easy way to do is just, if you do it early on, even if you have tiny objects, it's true that simulation do not show that the filling factor is large, but it's also true that we are struggling to get the velocities in the simulations that, for example, Chuck is finding. At least when we have done that, we always find velocity there, 200 km per sec, unless you pump it by hand, right? This is the approach that some people have taken, like saying, oh, these are the velocity that we observe, so we put the velocities at that given radius with that speed, and that's it. So winds, can expand large, even though the filling factor remains small, even with this assumption. But if you do, as we have chosen to do, just to do physical velocity come out low. And this, I suspect, is because there is something important that we often see in simulations, that there is a lot of info that is preventing this gas to expand freely as you would expect if there is no info. The question then that I'm puzzled that Chuck is never finding something like that in the observation. So that is what is really puzzling me. Nevertheless, even with such small bubbles, if you do all this at high redshift, the number densities of objects is so large, then you can get, I'm not saying that you get 100% filling factors, but 15 to 20 or even maybe 30 in some situations, you can get them. I don't know if it is enough or not, but if you do it at high redshift, it's certainly easy. The info thing, though, is something that I would like somebody here to comment, because I'm puzzled that in Lyman Break Galaxy, you will never see something that infalling onto the galaxy.
I
have a microphone.
Can you give him the mic back so that he can make his point afterwards?
I mean, all you need is for the effective covering fraction of infalling material to be significantly smaller than the covering fraction of outfalling stuff, and you wouldn't see it. It doesn't prevent it from being there. In fact, I'm certain that there's infall at the same time that there are
just statistical effects that you never go.
If the absorption is not as strong, these are, let's face it, they're crappy spectra. And you can see gross things, but you can't,
we don't see infall today either, right? It's not a well known. But I think we're on the wrong topic. That if we try to answer the first question, what's wrong with the assumption that of the metals in the IGM, we do see most of them because they're not a huge amount hot at high Z. We are indeed missing the metals. They're still in the galaxies. The reason is there's not that much feedback for the IGM. It's still there.
Maybe it's worth just summarizing, I think, what we know. So we know that the total amount of carbon-4 and silicon-4 doesn't evolve between redshift 5 and 2. We know that.
In the IGM.
And we also know from doing ionization corrections that in the photoionized warm phase, the metallicity doesn't strongly evolve between redshift 4 and redshift 2, and it's about 100 solar or so overall, mass-weighted. Then we know that galaxies are driving winds at redshift 3. We see that. We don't know how much metal they're ejecting exactly or where it's going, but they're driving winds. And then we know that in the hot phase of gas that we can't see at redshift 3 very well, at redshift 0 we have sort of a tenth solar metallicity overall. So somewhere between redshift 3 and redshift 0 we increased the total amount of metals in the intergalactic medium by a factor of 10 or so, it seems. And either that all happened between redshift 2 or redshift 0, or there are hidden metals at the high at redshift 3 that we're not seeing, or both. But I think you can't escape.
So the metals can still be in the galaxies at redshift 3, and we don't have a problem beyond the fact we don't have a way of assessing them properly.
But I think it could be the opposite. If the metal were really in the intergalactic medium of density about equal to the mean at redshift 2 or 3, just because of flux of the quasar, you would have an ionization level where O6 is not even the dominant ion any longer, it's O7. And you will have no way to find it. Therefore, we may be able to hide, even at redshift 2, some metal in the intergalactic medium with density around the average.
I think possible in principle, but it would require, I think, the trend of metallicity with density turning up again, because if you look at the trend that we see at relatively high density and extrapolate, then those low density regions don't contribute significantly to the total amount of metallicity. So it would have to turn up again, which is conceivable, but it would be a little surprising, I think. Well, we see it in the simulations we've looked at too. The metallicity is easily higher than what we inferred from the Lyman alpha force observations. It's just that you don't see the metals because they're too hot. So it really is tricky. I think what we can say though in measuring the carbon 3 to carbon 4 say is that we see that there are some metals in the photoionized gas, and we can reasonably reliably estimate the metallicity in those absorbers and how much overall metallicity we can get from that. But what we can't touch is stuff that we just wouldn't see in carbon 3 or in carbon 4. And that could easily be there.
Not quite that simple, as I said before. You need to heat them to temperatures much greater than 25K, which are a bit unnatural for galactic winds. Because otherwise you do see enough of it still that, as I showed, that the compressor simulation just doesn't work. Well, right after they escape, when the cross-section is a bit large. Well, these simulations, they didn't have metal cooling.
But sorry, if there was a quick question, if there was a hot component and high redshift, wouldn't you see that in the distribution of Doppler width of the Lyman alpha forest? I mean, nobody has ever said that the cutoff at high B values is just a selection effect. That's real. No, but if you don't see them, then the cutoff is just due to systematics, and I thought it was real.
It's either a 10 to the 7th or a 10 to the 4th.
Yeah. But many of these Doppler parameters are not thermal.
Yes, you can have a two-temperature distribution, but, it seems to me unlikely. You would expect a distribution of temperature. Why don't we see high Doppler with Lyman alpha forest cloud?
Most of these Doppler simulations that don't have hot gas.
You would fit your continuum right through.
Just a comment to look ahead to tomorrow's speakers, since people have looked ahead to my talk already. What Tim maybe tell us tomorrow is that in low redshift objects, where you know you see the winds directly, you don't see the metals either. You don't see them in the emission lines, in the optical, in the UV, and you don't see them. Okay. Well, you see, but you see much less than you would anticipate. You're seeing the total integrated abundances are low. Well, they're 10th solar. You're seeing the integrated in the X-ray spectrum. Okay, that's what I was. But you don't see them in your optical UV spectra. They're invisible in those ways. But I was thought I was saying.
Maybe. I mean, I think you can actually get a lot of physical insight out of looking at some of these local examples of winds carefully, because I mean, there's only a few good examples, but you see the metals from starburst. I mean, deposited in these hot halos that are kind of a few kiloparsecs in size. And the thing that's also nice is in these nearby systems now, besides seeing the X-ray part of the winds, we can also look at the cooler clouds in absorption against these nearby systems and compare the dynamics of the two. And in a way that's very similar to what Chuck sees at high redshifts in starbursts of similar luminosities, you know, relatively locally, you see similar outflow speeds of, you know, 400 or 500 kilometers per second is not unusual. But these are clouds that we know are, you know, that they must be embedded in this hot flow. And the fact that they do get up to speed to terminal velocities of 600 or 700 kilometers per second says this flow, I mean, must be moving very fast. And, you know, it's not being slowed down by the infall. And similar to the high redshift case, I mean, it's only one or two systems out of 40 where we see any infall into these galaxies. So the covering factor of the infall, even at low redshift, has got to be very small.
I agree with everything you're saying, but the first question is the problem. Why is that the size of the bubble that we see at the end of the bubble, but the second space that we see the bubble?
No, everybody
We're better at seeing large radii just because of the ways that we're measuring.
We see evidence for these on scales up to like 20 kiloparsecs now.
Too many people at the same time. Just that
okay.
One person now.
Maybe just move on to the next point and you continue in the coffee break. The next point was for Jacqueline, what we will learn from UV and X-ray absorption lines on the WOM.
Yeah, I think the two talks for tomorrow are going to answer partially already that question. I would like just to summarize, and maybe people who are going to talk tomorrow could add to what I would say. Right now, at low redshift, our current best of it, more used tracer. Now, I have a more used tracer is 06, and therefore the first question would be, is really 06 systematically a tracer of the wind, that is to say a hot gas? We began to know that there are multiphase, some of the 06 might be only photon and ice, and you could be out of equilibrium, you could have cooling gas. Therefore, in that sense, 06 might not be the best tracer, but still when you take it, you don't go very much down in column density just because you have to do that with either fuse or HST. And right now, instead of the 30 to 50% of baryon into the WIM, you have about 5%. Therefore, are you limited just by the tracer that you have chosen or the column density? And I think probably you are limited by the tracer. Best tracer would be, of course, 07 and 08. But they are X-ray tracer, and right now, unfortunately, our X-ray satellites are not powerful enough to do as good job like UV absorption. Column density limit that you could do in X-ray are nearly 100 times larger than those you could do in UV. Therefore, I know of only one clear case, and I think Romuald Davey, I mean, I talked to him yesterday, it's still the only one we know, a BL-Lakin outburst, where there are clearly two intervening systems, confirm 5 sigma. The pass, the redshift pass, is so small that in fact if you were wishing to transform with absolutely zero statistic that into number of system, that may come, that will be fairly large, but we have to remember the statistics are zero. Therefore, one thing we may be left with is Swift has just gone out, therefore target to study the WIM would be either BLAC in outburst, and there are program, target of opportunity program in both Chandra and XMM to do that, or GRBs after GLOW in the X-ray. But there is this question. Right now, we are not really probably finding the WIM. And what should we do? Before waiting for next generation telescope like Constellation X or ZEUS. And of course, we are very hindered by not having stage, because there might be a way in the UV, if we have O6, to distinguish whether O6 came from a fairly hot phase or cool. That is to say, iron, other iron. And other iron, which are very good to probe, are O5, which is an iron easy to see when there is some column density more than O6. It's just very much in the extreme UV. Therefore, you can begin to probe it with fuse only for redshift 0.5 or more, and it has been already seen, and Jason Prochaska and his student Hawk are a paper on that, and NEO-8, and that will probe temperature, let's say, up to 3 × 10⁵, and that's not the WIM, that's not 0708. And you have NEO-8, which is probing temperature up to 10⁶, which might become to probe the real WIM and 0708. Therefore, maybe we could use those EUV line and not to resort to X-ray, but the problem, we don't have STIS, and therefore we are a bit stuck. Were there any question or suggestion?
Well, let's make a general point, Jacqueline, that this subject, we're having this meeting at the level we're having at, which is a lot of ignorance, because we're not seeing a lot of what we really want to be seeing, right? The hotter gas, we're severely limited by carbon 4, oxygen 6, and then we run out of information. And that's what's held us up. We really want to be observing at much shorter wavelengths. It's technically difficult, right? The galaxy is semi-opaque at those wavelengths and so on. But the upshot of that is we could be stuck here for quite a while unless we solve the data side of it. This affects the whole of the meeting, basically.
And if I want to reinforce that point, indeed, for some of the O6 at redshift 2 to 0.5, we could also maybe have a small fraction which come from a hotter phase, and we would need NEO-8. But again, we need HST at 2,500 angstrom. And Reimers has a few such cases of bright quasar where he was trying to study the helium 2 forest, and indeed NEO-8 is seen associated with O6. But that's really a handful of objects. Therefore, that might be also a way to more constrain the O6 phase at redshift 2 to 0.5. But we need costs. I don't know who has the microphone. Is somebody has stolen the microphone?
A question. So what do you think of the perspective to see that gap, the WIM in emission in X-ray, soft X-ray? There have been claims in the last 2 or 3 years, or this one or two that I know.
I think Richard is probably better suited to answer.
Two groups in the United States put in small explorer proposals to do exactly that. And there's also been a paper on two Japanese teams have put an AstroPH paper in, and we came to exactly the same conclusions. And so now that we can build detectors that have energy resolutions of 2 eV in the X-ray that are truly imaging, we can detect the WIM in emission if we cover enough solid angle. The calculations show that you should get, if you believe Renu's cube, that is, that you should get high-density filaments roughly every 10 square arc minutes in the sky. And so you have to cover only a few tens of square degrees to have a representative measure of the local WIM in emission. And it's actually quite technically possible today.
What would be the over-density in this filament?
About 100.
Could you take them 100?
That's not the missing variant, right?
No.
Well, according to Renu...
And it's quite pessimistic on that, because it's like the metals, right? You see the low temperature tilt the iceberg here. Now you see the high density tilt the iceberg. If you really want to know the missing variants, then you have to go to such low over densities that you want to know the low in the background.
According to Renu's calculations, you get 30 to 60% of the... Oh, okay.
And that's fine.
But I'm saying you can see the overdensity of 100 gas.
Okay. Avi?
I have a question from a very ignorant theorist. If we talked about UV, optical, X-ray, what about radio? If you're throwing away metals in the IGM, you're throwing away magnetic fields if they're coming from stars. So what about radio? Can we use radio to find this hot metals?
No, you will see essentially the cool gas, not the hot one.
The cool gas, not
the cool one, fine, but not the hot one.
The only transition.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not on radio. We see radio lobes from radio loud galaxies.
Saying what gas will you see?
Well, radio lobes are very hot.
No, here on your right hand side.
I'll touch on some of the same subjects that you brought up here in my talk tomorrow. Just to give sort of a punchline, the omega baryon in the oxygen 6 absorbers at low redshift is comparable to the omega baryon in stars and gas inside galaxies. So by inference, there's in those absorbers there are as many metals as there are inside galaxies. So, I mean, it's still a small portion of the total amount of metals, but at least it's one indication of what's out there.
Yeah, but you could not maybe low enough in column density in O6. You could have much more if you had...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we could go another factor of 10. To get to the higher ionization stages, it's also quite feasible at low redshift to look for things like neon 8 and oxygen 5, so on. But we really need a factor of 10 improvement down in the far UV band, in the fuse band. That's completely feasible with current technology and could be done today if we had the money to do it. The other thing, tomorrow I'll describe a mission concept for actually imaging the web in O6 and Lyman alpha emission. And again, there are some differences among the theorists out there as to what the sensitivity levels need to be, but we're working on a NASA concept study to do that, so I'll describe that as well.
Okay. Well, no, Chuck has his microphone.
I was just going to ask the audience, to what extent should we take the fraction of metals that are in the galaxies relative to the metals in the intracluster medium as a sort of universal truth for throughout the universe? And is, you know, do we already know then how many metals are out there just by knowing how many stars there are in galaxies?
The yields in clusters, if birth from clusters don't agree with the yields of birth from the solar neighborhood. You may know more about this than me. I thought that if you compute the total amount of metals in the intercluster medium and compare it with the amount of stars and galaxies in clusters, get a yield that is differs quite a bit from what is inferred from the solar neighborhood, and it reaches also what is consistent with nuclear synthesis models in stars. So you need something different for clusters.
Absolutely. I've been a problem for 20 years, and 4 out of 5 theorists think that we need a top-heavy IMF.
Okay, question here.
Okay, I think I have a few.
Speak in the microphone, otherwise.
Oh, okay.
So I think I have a comments on this X-ray absorption line study of this warm-hot intergalactic medium. So basically, there's two types of detection so far in the X-ray band about these X-ray absorption lines. One is at redshift larger than zero, which is sort of in the main system. The other detection is are the local X-ray absorption line. So I should stress that both the detections are quite different. The intermittent system has very low condensity, which has condensity of like oxygen 7, which is probably only 10 to the 15 per centimeter square. But if you look at the local system, the condensity is very high, it's 10 to 16 per centimeter square. And the other difference is there are only a few report of the intermittent absorption system, which so far is probably only 4 to 5 detections. But in the local system, we actually did a survey of a number of AGN as a background to probe the X-ray absorption line. Out of the 22 target, we found 9 absorption lines. And especially when you spectral quality getting higher and higher, you see a lot, you basically, all the high quality spectrum, you see X-ray absorption lines. So that actually tells you, it seems like there is this sort of universal hot gas distributed out around us. But the next question is, where are these local gas? You know, it could be in the intergroup medium or in the in our Milky Way halo.
How far, therefore, you would say it extended?
Yeah.
What would be your guess?
Right. But the problem is that, you know, if you see 9, you know, line of sight at the different directions with high condensity, it tells you that it's something really close to us. In addition, we actually did a, you know, sort of test case. We look at, this low mass X-ray binary in the Large Magellan Cloud, which is only 50 kpc away. And we clearly see an X-ray absorption line there. So it implies there's this large amount of hot gas which enriched with oxygen distributed around us. So that's the sort of current status of this X-ray absorption study.
I wait for the microphone then.
I mean, it's an unusually rich line of sight, right? So, I mean, I wouldn't take it as particularly representative.
Okay.
Maybe we go to the next question then. Yeah, I can change the question a little. You can back it if you want to, and I think that's what David agreed to coordinate the discussion a bit.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to sit down. I wanted to open just by making my general summary statement that I don't think feedback's a problem for the IGM at the moment. That I kind of agree with Martin that the IGM data seems to fit just fine. Feedback's a problem for galaxies. That's where it originates. That's where the sources of the metals are and the energy, be it black holes or whatever, right? They're inside galaxies. They should have the most effect on galaxies, right? So I was very interested in Crystal's comments. Half the talks here should be on galaxies if we're talking about the connections between the two. And if you can't get the feedback right by studying individual galaxies, as Chuck's doing, as you might do locally, you're not going to see it in the IGM where it's having a fairly small effect. It's not jumping out at us with the models, you know, nowhere near. The models fit the data fine without it. It's hard to find it. You know, there are parameters we're tuning and so on. So that's my opening general comment, right? And I think a lot of this discussion's missed that point. I'd like to hear more on the, you know, the local observation as we go on. So, sorry? No, the metals, yeah, they do come out, but the point is, watch them going out. Don't wait until they've gone out and you can't find them anymore. It's too late. if you don't see them going out, you know, we're not interested. Sorry?
How do they go up?
How do they go up? No, but that's not a problem for the IGM. It's a problem for the galaxy.
I thought I showed state-of-the-art simulations with winds that mm-hmm. predicted IGM signatures that don't look anything like the observations. It's just not Lyman alpha. It's
yeah, but you also showed ones that fitted without the simulant, without the feedback.
That was.
So I noticed, so, yeah.
That's not possible solution. That we painted the metals on.
Go ahead. Yeah, let's get Rami.
Give him the microphone.
I don't have it.
Just to make a point out, yeah. I mean, oh. The reason you want to study the IGM is precisely because the IGM works so well for everything else, right? And that's why we want to study it. The reason that it's so hard to study galaxies is we don't know anything about what's going on.
That's why we want to study the IGM. Well, we know the metals are big.
That's unfair, right? For the people that study galaxies, well, yeah, star maybe. Formation histories, you know, the radius of metallicities and so
problem.
On.
But it's not. But I mean, we see the metals out there, and they have to get out there somehow. So it's not that we don't
see
them.
We see very little out there. Most of them are not out there.
Is that clear? I mean,
Let's talk on that a little more rather than my topic. Yeah. This is better.
So I think we see at redshift zero that in clusters most of the metals are actually outside of the galaxies. But I think the second data point is at redshift three, where I think we see at least tens of percent of the metals, you know, subject to uncertainties in the UV background, et cetera. But in the sort of most vanilla model interpretation of the Lyman alpha metallicity, a significant fraction of the metals that you would expect to be formed at redshift 3 are in the intergalactic medium. So
few percent,
even just the ones we see, it's still probably tens of percent.
Could be less than 10%. We've been having that discussion about what the mean metallicity might be at those redshifts. That was Simon's point.
But how do you get there without spoiling everything?
No, I'm fine they get out, but it's not obvious. I don't think they do spoil everything.
No, the filling factor may be small, but...
Why can they be just inside the Lyman break?
Most of them are. That's the point.
I'm talking about comparing the total amount of metals that you see in the Lyman alpha force to, say, omega star of 0.001 with a few tenths of solar or even solar metallicity, and they're comparable.
The Lyman break galaxies, you know, with 10 to the 10th solar magnitude of stars, metallicity is 0.6. If you sum them up,
Right, but you can't have more metals than you would generate from the stars. So I'm just saying that the amount of metal production you would expect from the stars is comparable to the amount you see in the Lyman alpha force. A lot of the metals have to get out there, both at redshift 0 and at redshift 3, I think.
Yeah, redshift 0, I don't agree redshift 0 either. I mean, I thought I just heard Ken saying that we know what the metallicity is in some areas of a local IGM, but to jump that out to say we know the average metallicity of the whole IGM,
no, this is
I'm
a
not
discussion
comfortable
we had earlier.
That.
We know that it's a third solar in clusters, and we know it's a third solar in groups.
That's a different argument.
And groups and clusters together comprise about a third of the total amount of baryons that are out there.
At redshift 0.
At redshift 0. So a third times a third is a tenth. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a tenth solar metallicity. That's already a significant amount of metals.
Yeah. I think we've stated there are issues in this area, so now I'm happy. on the topic that I was supposed to discuss. So the ultraviolet background. Yeah, this is in better shape because we can measure this, so it needs a little less discussion, I would claim. I think the way I look at the ultraviolet background is there are sources, so it's coming from stars and AGNs. You want the spectra of them, you want their space density, you integrate those up, and then what you do, it depends who you're giving it to. If you're giving it to a typical simulation, you've got to absorb it for them because they don't know how to do that. You've got to absorb it correct with frequency and so on. So I thought I would break it up into those points, and maybe we'll discuss the bits one by one. It might make better if we roll them all together, right? So first is just the sources. Right? And nothing else. Now, I've heard someone here that surprised me, which is some people claim we've already seen enough of the AGNs. We've gone faint enough to kind of know that we've seen the bulk of the flux, whereas recent papers are saying that's not the case, and when you integrate down luminosity function, you've got to go quite a bit fainter. So does anybody want to carry that topic, either claiming... Yeah, Richard?
Well, wait for an hour.
You want to give a 30 seconds?
But the more relevant ones are the optically selected ones in this case. And that's very clear. Now two groups get the same answer, and the answer is there are a lot fewer faint quasars than people had assumed up until last year.
But have we gone faint enough, I think is the point. Have we seen most of them by now, or have we not?
In the broad line objects, narrow line objects,
They don't produce much UV.
Right.
They don't produce much UV.
Right.
So you claim, did everybody agree with that? Well, we've seen the bulk of the sources that are emitting the high energy photons at least, right? The AGN type sources.
But I think what probably most people don't appreciate is that the contribution from quasars is now affected to lower integrators than people had assumed for the last 5 years. So if you go now to Francesco Hart and ask him for his updated quasar model, then you get a big surprise, because suddenly the things have dropped by factors 2 at redshift 2, 2.5 at redshift 3, and 4 at redshift 4.
Which version is this?
That's the version I got last week from him.
And published!
And I think that maybe shouldn't come so... And the reason for that is, I ask him, it's partially different cosmology, but it's mainly because in the original model there was a pale luminosity function that had this huge extrapolation to faint quasars that haven't been.
So can I follow up on that issue? Does that?
It's not pale. Let me just clarify that. The boiling luminosity parameter
Could I ask Jennifer whether the extra far UV luminosity that you were finding for the few sources has been rolled into this discussion, or is it not? So surely that compensates.
No, I don't think it has. But it's probably really affecting the lowest luminosity AGN, as I was showing.
That's what they're talking about, I think.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't think it's been folded into these calculations.
But it compensates, isn't it? Because you're seeing a factor
right.
of two or more flux
right.
than you would guess from a... say a B normalization or something
yeah,
like that.
It's just a question of how that will work with the flatter luminosity function.
Do you agree?
That won't really make
I think it will probably not compensate, because
yeah.
these are very low luminosity quasars found at low redshift. And I don't think they will contribute much to the integral, even if you make the slope harder.
Okay.
I think it might have effect if you go away from the ionization edge of hydrogen. Mm-hmm. If you go to a harder photon, then these will have an effect and might start to dominate and influence the integrated spectrum. But I think for hydrogen, the ionization
yeah.
edge, they will probably not make a large contribution.
Oh, but you said an important point there, because you want the number of high energy photons in particular from
yeah.
the AGNs, right? Because given that stars are probably very significant for the hydrogen ionization, the key reason you study the quasar emission is for the helium, et cetera, ionization.
Yeah.
Right? And so, okay, it's an interesting
question. Well, just to provide numbers on this, when we integrate the faint AGN luminosity function, as observed in the UV, from combo 17 down to the observed limit, then we get 97% of the UV luminosity density compared to when we integrate to zero luminosity. So we really get everything. That does not take account spectral shape variations as a function of luminosity. So this still has to be worked into.
Okay. Any more comments on sources?
Then there is Sloan that tells you a lot about redshift 4 and above. But it's very, I personally don't know of any, I like to have a luminosity function of quasar is equal 3. That's where they peak and that's where they start to go down. And I've not been able to find in the literature.
Okay.
Wait an hour. And he has it too.
Is it? You have it, but I mean, is this published? Or I know you have it, but.
Okay, got it. Note we also have to extrapolate above redshift 6, so we're going to do a lot of things we're trying to do. Now I want to mention absorption briefly. And the biggest problem with the absorption is we don't have accurate numbers of Lyman limits, particularly at lower redshift. When the redshift's less than 2.5, the Lyman limit's in the HST band, and HST didn't take many spectra. There are roughly 20 Lyman limits in the published samples, less than redshift 2. So there's a huge uncertainty in absorption there, probably more than there is in the sources.
I think it's
as surrogates. Yeah, as surrogates. But you'd like to know how much absorption at a given column, and you want to know that in some detail to get a good prediction. So the prediction is going to be pretty bad for what you hand over to the simulations, at least at the lower Z's. For anybody want to add anything to that, to the absorbers that are needed? But I was going to say a little bit about actually measuring the ultraviolet background. When we used Mike Norman's simulations to match the mean amount of absorption at redshift 1.9, we found a very good fit when we got all the concordant parameters right. So we had to get the sigma rate right and the amount of helium heating to get the B values right. We had to get everything right at once. But when we got that, we found we could fit everything simultaneously. It seemed to be unique as long as there was no feedback, meaning if we didn't put feedback in, we had the right number of parameters. If we put it in, we got one too many, which we could trade off against the shape of the ultraviolet background, right? Because as you change the shape, you heat the IGN. You make more AGN photons versus softer galaxy photons, the thing's going to get hotter. It'll broaden the lines, and if you look at lines carefully, you'll see that. You won't necessarily see it, but you can see that. So from that line of work, which follows on from what Rauch and many other groups are doing about 5 years ago now, we think we can get the ultraviolet background intensity for hydrogen to about 25% error, where that error comes from a long list of the cosmological things you need to get right. Right, such as the baryon density 5% error, and the lambda has a 5% error, and the sigma 8 has a 10% error, and so on. If you get those things wrong, you get the background density wrong. Now, the early papers used that method. They used the mean amount of absorption to get the baryon density, and they typically got too many baryons and so on. And we know why now, because they didn't have a concordant cosmological model, so they didn't stand a chance in some sense. So a lot of sensitive things. So my claim is that at least at hydrogen, we're going to be in quite good shape as long as the feedback doesn't bite us. Right? Now, we can almost get out of that because as we go up in red shift, the feedback should be changing, right? Whereas the cosmological parameters should be constant. With one, well, they should be, right? With one exception, with one exception, the ultraviolet background, right? So we have exactly enough information to solve, basically. Though as you look at things more carefully, you get a little more. So you want to.
Not all of them.
I guess I was just going to say that it's one thing to get the mean intensity of the background correct. It's another thing to get the sort of match the normalization and shape of the column density distribution, which is another way to get it. And that will, in fact, tell you a little bit more information about whether feedback is important. So if, for instance, there was a lot of hot stuff at low densities, you might expect a quite different shape of the column density distribution, and this would be sort of an additional constraint that you could use to do that.
Yeah. I mean, the generalization of your point is what is the sufficient set of data, right, statistics applied to the data, right, that will guarantee that you've got the information out when you then match that to the simulations. We don't know the answer to that question, so I kind of agree with you. Yeah.
Redshifts above 6 or so, I think once you get into the regime of metal-free stars, that you were making a distinction between the soft spectrum from stars and the hard spectrum from quasars. But that distinction might blur at higher redshifts where, I don't know, if you use Wilker-Brahm or Jason Tumlinson's models for metal-free stars, where they become relevant for helium reionization as well. How to constrain those is a little bit more tricky. Even though helium can contribute 2 electrons, it's still, because its number density is relatively low, you're talking about at most a 16% boost in the optical depth to electron scattering from the CMB, so that's not very strong. So perhaps constraining the thermal evolution at the IGM, which I think has come up, and also maybe some speakers have mentioned this already, have come in late to the conference, but also the eta parameter, where you mentioned the hardness and the local effects of hard sources, that might be important too from POP3 stars.
That was my next point, actually. So saying we could do some progress with the ultraviolet background at the hydrogen ionization, that's got to be the easiest. We then have to try to do it for helium, and I'm quite depressed there, even though Sloan, etc., are finding plenty of targets. There's no obvious way of getting those spectra. We need a lot more spectra. Getting the helium-2 ionizing flux is going to need a lot more than 5 or 6 spectra. We're just miles away from that.
I think we should take that as a last remark, because I'm pretty sure you don't want to miss your coffee. So
there have been
further comment, and then we break it.
There have been now two detailed studies of helium-2 Gunn-Peterson targets with fuse, both of which used the same sight line, and both of which basically found that the helium-2 forest was quite dense, but clearly evolving in opacity around redshift 3. We also found a surprisingly large variation in this ratio of eta that Aparna mentioned. So either surprisingly large variation in the hardness of the spectrum over, you know, megaparsec scales, or some sort of density effects that we didn't really understand. There is now in hand and being analyzed today a second sightline with fuse. Beyond that, I don't know if Ken has any more information, but I think two is probably all we're going to get with fuse.
Yeah. So that's going to remain a big uncertainty there, the spectrum shape. I guess I'll stop, unless anybody else has got anything.
Well, thank you for being a lively audience, and enjoy the coffee.